Okay, I want to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Mark Katz. He's a first-time ARSC attendee. He's a doctoral student in musicology at the University of Michigan. He's currently writing his dissertation on the influence of recording technology on early 20th century musical life. Before entering graduate school, he worked for a year at the Library of Congress, where he processed the recorded sound and music collections of Vladimir Yuzhaevsky and Yasha Heifetz. The title of his talk today is Aesthetics Out of Exigency, Violin, Vibrato, and the Phonograph.
Hello. Oh, there's a handout coming around. Violinists have been using vibrato for centuries. But for more than 300 years, vibrato was considered just an embellishment, artistic only when used sparingly. But early in this century, the practice changed. Professional, classically trained violinists began using vibrato more often and more conspicuously, and they came to regard it as essential to expressive violin playing. So what was once a special effect at one time had become an integral element of violin sound. Well, this dramatic change is something of a mystery. Many people have commented on the matter, though few have offered answers, and no one has really explored the issue in any depth. So today I hope to shed some light on this mystery. Before I offer a theory, however, let's consider for a moment the rise of what I'm going to call the new vibrato. Before the 20th century, it was the bow, not the vibrato, in other words, the right hand and not the left hand, that violinists considered the most important agent of musical expression. In fact, the bow is often called the soul of the violin. Most 18th and 19th century treatises don't even mention vibrato, and it was only in 1900 that the first manual on violin vibrato was even published. And even it noted that good violin tone is possible without what it called this fascinating embellishment. The widespread use of vibrato first seems to have been reported in 1908. Early commentators viewed the trend with some distaste. One compared the violinist's continually shaking left hand to jelly on a plate of a nervous waiter. But in the coming years, vibrato came to be more widely used and accepted. A 1910 German treatise proclaimed that artistic finish is impossible without a correctly made vibrato. In 1916, an English critic declared vibrato indispensable. In 1924, the eminent teacher Carl Flesch noticed that, if we consider the celebrated violinists of our day, it must be admitted that in nearly every case, they employ an uninterrupted vibrato. And by 1929, the practice had become so entrenched that one American teacher could write what would have been heretical nearly 30 years before. Violin playing without vibrato, he said, is like a day without the sun, dismal and gray. Well, for more direct evidence of this new trend, we may turn to early 20th century recordings. Let's consider three recordings of Brahms's Hungarian Dance No. 1. The first, from 1903, is played by Josef Joachim, a close friend of Brahms who transcribed these dances for the violin. Now, Joachim preached against the overuse of vibrato, and as we'll hear, he followed his own advice. If you look at example one on your handout, you'll notice that he vibrates sparingly on only 9 out of 34 possible notes, and sometimes not even for the duration of the note. He uses vibrato to distinguish repeated pitches and to intensify certain moments, as he does in measures 7 to 9, which lead to the highest note in the passage. Later recordings by Yasha Heifetz and Tasha Zeidel reveal an altogether different approach. Both show greater use and intensity of the vibrato. You can hear it on 18 notes in Heifetz's recording and 25 in Zeidel's. While neither artist uses vibrato indiscriminately, theirs is much more an organic part of their sound than Joachim's. So I'll play these now, and even if you don't read music, you should be able to gather from the little squiggly lines the difference between the three excerpts. So if we can now hear those. First, Joachim. Yasha Heifetz, much more of a vibrato. Now Tasha Zeidel, if you thought Heifetz had a lot of vibrato. Well, many similar comparisons could be made. A broader survey, however, would only underscore what I hope is clear from the written and oral evidence I've just presented, that the first decades of the 20th century witnessed a fundamental transformation in the use of vibrato on the violin. So now let's return to the central question of this paper. Why did the practice of vibrato change? Well, I would argue that the conspicuous, continuous vibrato arose in response to a technology that came to play a crucial role in professional violin playing earlier in the century. And this technology, of course, is sound recording. A constant and strong vibrato became increasingly useful for recording violinists, and it did so in three ways. First, it helped violinists compensate for the peculiarities of both acoustic horns and microphones. Second, it could obscure imperfect intonation, which is more noticeable on record than in a live setting. And third, it could offer a greater sense of the performer's presence on record, conveying to unseeing listeners what body language and facial expressions would have communicated in concert. When recording acoustically, the violinist had to deal with the limited sensitivity and uneven response of recording horns and diaphragms. Vibrato may have helped compensate for these limitations. Vibrato creates periodic fluctuations in air pressure, fluctuations that contribute to a sound's loudness. By using more vibrato, then, it is possible that the recording artist could increase the effective loudness of a note without overplaying and without playing dangerously close to the horn. A second possibility concerns the frequency modulation involved in vibrato. A vibrated tone produces more frequencies than a straight tone, both in terms of the fundamental note and the overtone series. This scattershot effect may have helped project notes to which a horn or diaphragm responded poorly, or it may have mitigated the detrimental effect of playing certain notes that coincided with particular resonances of the horn. I'd like to thank Peter Copeland of the National Sound Archive in London for suggesting those last possibilities. Now, perhaps one of these hypotheses would explain the difference between two recordings I want you to hear now. These are two acoustic recordings of a Chopin nocturne arranged for violin, one from 1910 by Misha Elman, the other by Yasha Heifetz in 1918. Both are recorded with Victor. The last note on this piece is a very high E flat, the fourth E flat above middle C. As we will hear, it is almost inaudible on Misha Elman's recording, but it's much more easily heard on Heifetz's. This seems, in my mind, to be connected to the use of vibrato. Elman uses no vibrato on the high note, and it practically disappears. Heifetz's E flat is audible, and is audible by virtue of the vibrato, which gives the note its pulsing quality. So now I'll have the tape played, and you'll want to follow along in example two. First, Misha Elman. Notice how the last note just disappears. Now Heifetz. Listen for the pulsing quality in the last note. Actually, I think it was a little hard to hear in this room. Well, while violinists recording acoustically had to overcome the system's insensitivity, a very different problem faced violinists recording with microphones. The problem was that microphones were too sensitive, at least in the respect that they picked up the frictional sounds of the moving bow, sounds that were seldom heard in the concert hall. Vibrato, it seems, could help violinists project their sound to microphones, allowing them to ease up on bowing pressure, but without sacrificing intensity of tone. Veteran recording artist Louis Kaufman has made this very point. This is what he told John and Susan Harvitz in their book, Edison, Musicians, and the Phonograph. This is something of a trick, Kaufman reported, getting around the surface noise and yet getting the intensity at the same time. The vibrato has to be somewhat heightened. It has to be somewhat faster than you really need for a public hall. So Kaufman knowingly increased his vibrato to meet the special needs of recording. Perhaps others recording with microphones also began to find that a heightened vibrato met the demands of the new process. Indeed, many violinists whose recording careers spanned the acoustic and electrical eras can be heard using a stronger vibrato in the later electrical recordings. In addition to aiding in the projection of sound, vibrato also helped recording violinists hide imperfect intonation. While mistakes in intonation are of course noticeable in a live performance, they pass quickly, at least sometimes, and may be obscured if the listener is far away or is paying close attention to the visual aspect of the performance. Poor intonation is much more easily perceived on recordings, however, because of the performer's proximity to the horn or the microphone, and because of the lack of the visual element. More important, recordings are repeatable, bad intonation and all. And we probably all know of otherwise enjoyable performances, recorded performances, that are blemished by a sour note, which after many hearings we come to expect and dread. So where does vibrato fit into this? Well, violinists not using vibrato must be absolutely precise in terms of finger placement. Otherwise, any slight inaccuracies will be immediately heard as out of tune. Paradoxically, with vibrato, one need not be precise in order to sound precise. A note played with vibrato, as long as it's not too slow or too wide, is heard as a single pitch, which of course is the result of a rapidly moving left hand. Thus, as long as the violinist vibrates immediately upon placing the fingers, precise positioning is less necessary than when using a straight tone. Significantly, the use of vibrato to avoid bad intonation came to be widely recognized in the age of recording. In 1921, the famous teacher Leopold Auer described the overuse of vibrato as an ostrich-like endeavor to conceal bad tone production. And in 1924, Carl Flesch noted that violinists using vibrato may, in his words, create the impression of playing in tune. So taken together, the heightened perceptibility of poor intonation on records, the possibility that vibrato could compensate for errant finger placement, and the concurrence of the rise of the new vibrato and the increased recording activity among violinists all suggest the following conclusion: that professional concert violinists began to use more vibrato in the age of recording, in part to conceal imperfect intonation from the unforgiving phonograph. Now, I say in part not to hedge, but to acknowledge a final way in which vibrato may be understood as a response to the exigencies of recording. I would argue that vibrato could also help compensate for the loss of the visual element in recordings. In a concert setting, performers communicate to audiences, and audiences react to performers not solely through sound, but through sight as well. Consider what Robert Schumann once wrote about Franz Liszt's piano playing. Within a few seconds, tenderness, boldness, exquisiteness, wildness succeed one another. The instrument glows and flashes under the master's hands. He must be heard and seen, for if Liszt played behind a screen, a great deal of poetry would be lost. A recent psychological study confirms Schumann's last remark. The study tested the ability of subjects to guess the expressive intention of performing musicians. The subjects experienced performances in three ways. First, by watching and listening at the same time. Second, by listening but not watching the performance. And third, by watching the performance but not listening to it. The study, remarkably enough, found that subjects were most accurate in specifying the performer's intentions through sight alone, more accurate than when hearing the performance but not seeing it, or hearing and seeing it at the same time. Now, the implication of Schumann's remark and this psychological study is that listeners lose a great deal of information about the expressive manner of performances heard on recordings. I propose that the more frequent and more prominent use of vibrato helped recording violinists express to unseeing listeners what their gestures and expressions could not. It's no coincidence that in the age of recording, violinists began to recognize that the vibrato could help convey emotion. Vibrato was variously described as reflecting the violinist's innermost soul or as an inner psychic vibration. And before the 20th century, you would have never come across comments like these. And if you did, they would have been made about the bow, not about the vibrato. Violinists saw another important function in vibrato as well, the individualization of tone. Siegfried Eberhardt wrote in 1910 that the individual characteristics of different artists are recognizable only when the vibrato is employed. And in 1924, Carl Flesch made a similar remark, pointing out that vibrato could even identify an unseen violinist. This is what he said. If two violinists play the same sequence of tones on the same instrument behind a curtain, each using his own vibrato, the individual player may be easily and surely distinguished, while without the participation of the left hand, the identity of the player can only be determined by chance. I believe that the new focus on the vibrato as both a means for conveying emotion and for distinguishing among violinists is connected to recording's missing visual dimension. When seeing accompanies hearing, as had long been the rule, there is no question as to the identity of the performer, and the expressiveness of the performance is strongly a function of the visual and visceral impact of the artist's physical presence. It was purely hypothetical for Schumann to consider Liszt playing out of sight. It just wasn't done. But when Carl Flesch spoke of listening to two unseen violinists, he was not being fanciful, for every recording artist plays and is heard as if behind a curtain. Although there was no way for recording violinists to replace the visual dimension, it was possible to put a clearly individual stamp on their playing, and even to restore, perhaps, some of that lost poetry through the use of the vibrato. A survey of early recordings supports this conclusion. Misha Elman's throbbing can be easily distinguished from Jascha Heifetz's nervous vibrating, and no one would confuse Fritz Kreisler's omnipresent vibrato for Marie Hall's essentially decorative use of the technique. I'm sure you could think of other examples. And within a single work, any of these artists might choose to emphasize certain notes or phrases or to communicate increasing or relaxing emotional intensity through the vibrato. Yet while every variety, shade, and speed of vibrato may be heard, the study of historical violin recordings clearly reveals the transformation of vibrato from an accessory to expressive violin tone to a constituent of it. I hope to have made a compelling case linking recording and the rise of the new vibrato. Let me summarize. First, the timing's right. We hear the beginnings of this new vibrato just at the time recording became an important professional activity among violinists. And second, through the use of the vibrato, violinists were able to meet challenges specific to recording, such as the insensitivity of acoustic horns and the problematic sensitivity of microphones, the enhanced perception of poor intonation on record, and finally, the lack of the visual element in recording. I should make clear, however, that by focusing on the influence of recording, I'm not eliminating other possibilities from consideration. For example, that singers or particular string players had an impact on the practice. But these are contributing and not at all contradictory causes. And I would maintain that sound recording was the only necessary condition for the advent of this new vibrato. The question still remains, however, of what exactly this conclusion illuminates. In other words, so what? Well, most specifically, we may now better understand the forces behind an important change in violin performance practice, one whose causes have not been thoroughly explored before. But there are broader implications of this study as well, for it questions the received wisdom concerning the nature of sound recording. Recording has long been understood as a tool for capturing and preserving the ephemeral art of musical performance. Ironically, however, what is taken to be solely a preservational tool is also, in fact, a catalyst. And not only may recording influence the way in which music is made, it also has the power to shape our standards of beauty in musical performance. As we have seen, a practice that arose as an accommodation to practical circumstances later came to be valued for its expressive potential. Necessity, it seems, may sometimes be the mother of aesthetics. Thank you. Thank you. Questions? Yes, sir. That's a good question, and I avoided it in this paper, but I take it up in my dissertation. I think it was the same. They were reacting to the same force, because from the research I've done into singing, which is admittedly not nearly as much as in violin playing, I found that there is also a transformation in the use of vibrato, that around the turn of the century, singers started using more vibrato, and that's documented in various places. One thing that's interesting, I think it may have been a little bit early, perhaps because singers were recording earlier, but I also found out, this is what Peter Copeland told me, that when singing into an acoustic horn, you get resonant, you get some feedback, and that perhaps when they were singing and certain notes matched certain resonance of the horn and came shouting back at them, one possibility is that they started using vibrato to smooth that out a little bit. That's certainly hypothetical, but I would say to answer the question is that I'm sure singers had an influence on violin playing. It's been documented throughout history, but I think in this case, sound recording influenced singers as well as violinists. Yes?
I have a two-part question, but I'll ask it one at a time.
Okay.
First, I think it's worth remembering that Joachim was born in 1833. Now, given that, there's obviously no recorded evidence, but based on the research you've done, is there any reason to believe that Joachim's use of vibrato in 1903, near the end of his career, was any different than his use of vibrato, say, in 1860?
I don't think there is. Certainly, he was 72. He died the next year. His playing was probably a little shaky, probably more so in the right hand with the bow. But I've read his violin school, and he goes on and on talking about how violinists should not use vibrato. And I've read also accounts of his playing that suggest that he used vibrato very sparingly. So I don't think age had to do with it. So.
That was an editorial comment, I apologize. But he justifies his use of rapid tempi. His justification for
I heard a yes. That's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that. I don't believe that violinists not using vibrato have a hard time sustaining their tone. I think it depends on the hall. It depends on their technique. I think that violinists could play without vibrato and still sustain their tone. So I don't really buy Norrington's argument. Yes?
I'd like to come back to something that you said at the beginning of the paper, and that is the expressive, the primary emphasis on expression was the right hand, bow up. And what does that have to do with recording? In other words, I understand your argument for in favor of vibrato. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, well, for one thing, well, I'm not saying that that they're mutually exclusive, that you can't have a good bow technique and a good vibrato technique. It's just that it seems historically that that at one point, actually for the last couple hundred years before the turn of the century, the main expressive device was the bow, but also I should mention portamento. But I would say one thing is that may have hampered violinists, their bowing, is getting close to the horn. I've read accounts in John Susan Harvitt's book about violinists bumping into the horn and having to play a little more conservatively. So maybe that also links to vibrato compensating for perhaps having to scale back on vigorous bowing. Or
I do think you're right.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering whether it is. There are a lot of things that could be said about that in terms of the bowing technique. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I just wondered what the connection would be.
Well, it's hard to say, but that's a good question. Yes.
being kind and kept out and was considered, they must say, by the teachers of that earlier period. You're getting not only the pleasant musicians coming.
Well, it's hard to say, but that's a good question. Yes.
Thank you.
Now I understand. I've tried to come in. This is a 20-minute distillation of a 50-page. Right, I agree. One thing that, though, I just say is that, remember, Joachim did not use a lot of vibrato. So his Hungarian, we can't say that his Hungarian roots influenced the use of the vibrato because he wasn't using it. But where'd they get it from? Not from him. Yeah, the other sisters, yeah. But he taught his students not to use vibrato, so I don't think I don't see how he could have influenced. But I would just say that I agree, of course, that this is not one-dimensional. My point is to bring up something that probably many of you have not thought of, and that's why I'm hoping to contribute. Let me get someone else, yes. Really? Well, I'd be one of them. Yes. Right. Well, what I'm saying, that's what I'm saying, is that the reason why we hear vibrato, that we hear the note at all in Heifetz's, is because it's compensating for this lack of the frequency response. And that's why we don't hear it. Certainly. But if you listen to it again with some headphones, what you hear is almost not so much a note as just a pulsing. That's why I get the sense that this vibrato is what comes through. Yes?
With respect to the vibrato used by singers, that's a very long sentence.
Right.
I would recommend you read it. Earlier editions of Rose Dictionary, particularly the specific sentence dealing with old singers, I'm talking about from the 18th century, even earlier, there are many commentaries about so-and-so with the excessive vibrato.
Right. Well, one thing I've seen in both singing and violin playing is that vibrato comes in waves, but what we have here is something different because for practically the past, I don't know, 75 years, we've had a constant vibrato, whereas in the past, it's been associated with a single artist, maybe for a much smaller span of time. Yes, Mr. Weil? Well, I don't think any of the violinists we heard were using Stroh violins. I couldn't imagine any of them using it. And it's my sense, maybe others would know better, is that no violinist of Heifetz's stature or Joachim's stature would deign to play the Stroh violin. Now, maybe that would have allowed violinists to play without using vibrato, but I guess we'll never know since violinists never really picked up. But I'm sure that could have compensated. Okay, I think, well, thank you very much, and I'd hope to talk to some of you later.
Yeah, hey, flip your thing over.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Great, thanks, Mark. Mark's going to be around for the conference, so I'm sure there's going to be plenty of opportunity to talk to him about some of these great ideas.